today. The government's plan to end the coronavirus lockdown includes an app downloaded onto your phone. But could that really provide the key to getting out of this nightmare?
The island's lovely at this time of year. Went out for a bike ride yesterday and saw a sea eagle on the south coast, which was quite spectacular. He's just chilling out on a fence post. All in all, to be honest, during the current situation, I think there's very few places that I'd rather be in the country at the moment, actually.
Tom Moore is a doctor living in Cowes on the Isle of Wight. From the island's north coast near his home, you can see Southampton 2 miles away across the water. When did you first hear about the government's contact tracing app?
Last week was the first time I heard about it when Matt Hancock appeared on the TV.
From tomorrow, we will begin to pilot test, track and trace on the Isle of Wight, starting with health professionals and rolling out this week to all citizens. Where the Isle of Wight goes, Britain follows.
Have you downloaded the app?
I have, yes.
Tell me what it looks like.
When you download it, it asks you to enter your postcode. It then tells you to turn your Bluetooth on and your location services. If you feel unwell, you press a menu, and then it basically asks you two questions. It's, do you have a high temperature, and do you have a continuous cough?
Ministers believe that this island community of around 140,000 is the perfect testing ground for an experiment that could provide a way out of our coronavirus nightmare. If enough people download this app, then in theory, it can provide an anonymised real-time map of where COVID-19 is spreading and issue warning alerts to people who may have come into contact with it. But there could be some teething problems, especially in Tom's line of work.
I suppose the danger, if it said you've got to go and self-isolate because you've come into contact with someone with symptoms, is anybody who works in a hospital. Now, I would be astounded if I've not come into contact with someone with symptoms.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, of course. Just working in the hospital means you're constantly around people.
So the danger is that, you know, they'll end up sending everyone home in the next few days.
And there are already worries about privacy too. How does it feel to have something in your pocket tracking your every move?
That is the concern. Personally, it doesn't upset me too much. What they've said, and I'm not a technology expert, so I can't verify this myself, but it doesn't sort of send something saying you came into contact at the co-op on Mill Hill Road at 5 a.m. You know, it just says...
What were you doing at the co-op Mill Hill Road at 5 a.m, Tom?
Well, you have to go at that time to get in, otherwise there's a 45-minute queue.
But the biggest challenge could be one of scale, because this app will only work if ministers can persuade tens of millions of people to sign up. Tom has heard that about 3/4 of his hospital colleagues are prepared to give it a go.
You know, if that's sort of replicated around the island or around the country, then, you know, you're probably going to get enough people downloading it to make it work. But I don't think the NHS has a great record in terms of IT know-how, so I wouldn't be surprised if some scandal comes out of this later, but who knows?
Yesterday, Boris Johnson was accused of causing confusion and division after publishing the plan for Britain's gradual lifting of the coronavirus lockdown. Part of the exit strategy is the app being trialled on the Isle of Wight. But can they persuade enough people to trust them and sign up? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what is the government's COVID-19 tracking app and will it work? Alex Hearn, UK technology editor at The Guardian. We've been in the middle of this crisis now for 2 months. And so far, the government response has been pretty low tech. They've told us to wash our hands. They've told us to stay at home. The same type of advice that was given out during the 1918 Spanish flu. But some think that the way out of this is going to have to be very high tech. What is a contact tracing app?
So a contact tracing app is fundamentally a piece of technology that uses a mobile phone to help people find out if and when they have been exposed to a carrier of coronavirus. Most apps use Bluetooth, the same technology that connects your phone to wireless headphones. Basically, your phone is constantly screaming out over Bluetooth, "Hi, I'm here, my name is," and then a random string of letters and numbers. Other phones are screaming that same information and listening for any other names they hear. And in doing that, what they're collecting is effectively a database of every single phone that they've been near. That database is, in effect, a record of every single person you've been exposed to. That means if one of them later finds out that they have coronavirus and have been infectious for the past 7 days, say, they can, in partnership with the NHS, warn every single person their phone tells them they've been exposed to that, well, all of those people may have caught coronavirus from them.
If your phone pings me and tells me you've been in contact with somebody who is saying they have coronavirus, what is that appropriate action for me? Do I then get told I need to take a test, or do I start self-isolating, and for how long?
The important thing is as soon as you get symptoms, then you know that you've had the symptoms. And one of the things that we're testing on the Isle of Wight is whether actually the best thing is for you to self-isolate in case you develop the symptoms. If the test comes back negative, then you can be released from that and go back.
From listening to them, it's not completely clear yet what the implications of coming close to a person who reports symptoms will be, but clearly it could be incredibly disruptive. If someone you queue up behind in a cafe gets a cough and taps that into their app, you might find yourself quarantined. But what's the end goal? What do they believe that this could achieve?
So the single biggest advantage is it can achieve people self-isolating when they are infectious but not symptomatic. For it to meaningfully reduce the infection rate directly, you would need estimates of around 60 to 80% of people having the app installed and running at any given time. That 60 to 80%, including everyone who doesn't have a phone, everyone whose phone can't run these apps because it's 6 or 7 years old, everyone whose phone has run out of battery in the course of their day. It's a really, really big ask. You're talking about hitting sort of the penetration of Facebook overnight.
Facebook? Facebook is absolutely massive. Surely that is not achievable. What are they going to do to persuade people to sign up?
Bluntly, with an appeal to people's desire to stop coronavirus.
The more people who have the app, the better. The more people we'll be able to protect and the more lives that we'll be able to save.
The same way that they've done most of the public health campaigns to date. On the big 5 p.m. briefing when Matt Hancock first delivered details about the trial in the Isle of Wight, he adapted the government's widely used slogan.
Please download the app to protect the NHS and save lives.
If we go out of lockdown, the government can say, if you like leaving the house, install this app.
But look, even if they get those eye-watering numbers to sign up, it's not a magic bullet, is it? The countries that have done the best contact tracing haven't done it all through an app.
This app is not the beginning and end of contact tracing. The government is hiring 18,000 human beings to do contact tracing the old-fashioned way.
We're preparing for this now by hiring an initial 18,000 people.
Speaking to people with coronavirus, asking them what they've done, who they've met, and then calling up those contacts manually and going, "Hi, I'm from the government, stay at home, please." That is actually how countries that have brought down the rates of infection for coronavirus have done it, because people respond better to being told to stay at home if they are told by a person with a clipboard than if they get a ping on their phone.
Okay, so right now there's quite a lot of controversy about the government's confusing first steps at lifting the lockdown. And now this next step, the app, also has massive potential pitfalls. And some of that is linked to the fact that Britain decided to design its own version rather than go for an off-the-shelf offer from Apple and Google. There are a couple of reasons for that. Our government wanted people to be able to notify the app after self-diagnosing their symptoms rather than only after a positive test. And that's not compatible with the Apple and Google app. And they wanted to hold the data centrally. We'll come to that point in a minute. But first, hasn't designing our own app meant technical problems from the start?
Because our phones have limited battery life, all modern smartphones do some power control. That's why if you try and switch to an app that you haven't opened in a few days, it takes a couple of seconds to load up. But if you switch to an app that you used 5 minutes ago, it's waiting there and ready to go. The government has found some canny ways around a lot of this.
It's been designed with a form of Bluetooth that conserves power so the app won't drain your battery.
If any phone hears another phone, it wakes back up and the count of whether or not it gets shut down in the background is restarted. And the app will periodically send you notifications that basically say, hey, reopen the app so it doesn't get put in the background. But if two iPhones, and it's only iPhones because they're more aggressive about closing these background apps to preserve battery life, if two iPhones are left in isolation for long enough, they both drop into a sort of listen-only mode. The government thinks this won't be a concern. It thinks this will mostly affect rural areas. It thinks anywhere busy like a tube carriage will have enough Android devices and enough active devices to wake up any device that has fallen into this listen-only mode. But this is a problem that the government wouldn't have to solve if they went with the Apple and Google offer.
And what about the way that the data is stored?
It's not really how, it's whether. So our version is what's known as a centralized app. That means that the NHS, when you send your data up, has a record of every phone that you've been in close proximity to in the last 2 weeks. Apple and Google's version, by contrast, doesn't send that information up. In our model, the NHS can very quickly build up a detailed graph of who's been interacting with who. That's not linked to real names. It would be quite hard to re-identify, but not impossible. Under Apple and Google's approach, by contrast, it is impossible to re-identify people from the information the NHS holds because it's given such limited information. There are positives and negatives to both approaches. In Apple and Google's approach, the NHS is severely hindered in the amount of extra information it gets from running this contact tracing app that it can use to fight coronavirus. But in the NHS's version, it has to say, ultimately, trust us, we're the government, trust us, we're the NHS. And for people who don't trust this government or who don't trust the NHS, that might be an ask that could prevent them from installing the app. And that is the worst case scenario.
Right. So basically, the Apple and Google app holds the information on individual phones rather than a centralized government database. I can see why it's useful for the government to have that information in fighting COVID, as you say. But there is a real privacy issue, especially with a risk of re-identifying people.
The bigger problem for trust is less about re-identification and more about other uses that this data might be put to. So it's fine if those other uses are, we want to be able to track the spread of coronavirus. We want to be able to know how many infections each new infection leads to so we can more easily calculate the R0. It's less good if that extra use is, we want to try and arrest people who are breaking lockdown in dangerous ways, or we want to see if people who are infectious are going to particular businesses more often so that we can go and close down those businesses. That's the sort of thing that people start getting a bit dicey about.
And you talk about trust. Isn't one of the reasons that people are perhaps a little reluctant to trust because the government aren't answering certain questions? I mean, we touched on this yesterday when we were talking about an app they're using in India where there's a lack of transparency. Isn't the same true here?
It is. It is very much the case that the government needs to A, answer questions, and B, commit to having some of those limits on it. At the same time, I think one of the reasons why the government is being a bit blasé about this is because the government genuinely believes that it's just not actually collecting all that much data. It's true that what it is collecting is ultimately a social graph, a network of which phones have been in contact with which other phones. But if you compare it to something like the amount of data that a typical Google user sends to Google in any given day, it's nothing.
And that's if the government were to do anything with your data. What about hackers? Is there a risk there?
Always, yes. Any extra collection of bulk data creates a new risk that will then be hacked. At the same time, it is by no means the most dangerous collection of data the government has. You know, this is ultimately the same government that protects all of our tax records. It's the same government that already has all of our medical data. So while I wouldn't be so blasé as to say don't worry about hackers, I would say that hackers are not the main concern here.
Can I ask about any links to Downing Street's chief strategist, Dominic Cummings? When he ran Vote Leave, he worked with a tech company called Faculty, run by two brothers, Mark and Ben Warner. Ben has since then become an advisor in Downing Street. Now, our colleagues here at The Guardian have revealed that Faculty is helping to build a computer model to help the government in the fight against coronavirus. It's called the COVID-19 Data Store. Their lawyers say they won that contract fair and square in a tender, and it's separate to the app. But there is mistrust.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good example as to how this government has really underplayed the value of trust and of consent of the governed. I do not believe that Dominic Cummings or the Warner brothers are involved in the contact tracing app. The problem is that Dominic Cummings is a man who has laughed at the idea of needing trust and respect from half the country. Very publicly, his view about governing Britain has been, if 52% of the country trusts you and 48% of the country doesn't, you've won. We're now finding that this is exactly the sort of situation in which that belief and that justification backfires. The government needs the trust of, well, at least 60 to 80% of the UK to install this app. And I've been having conversations with people who do not trust when the government says Dom Cummings isn't involved because they do not trust the government. That's going to be hard, if not impossible, to turn around in 2 weeks.
Clearly, there are tough challenges for the government. Just last week, the Joint Committee on Human Rights said there weren't enough privacy protections in place yet. And that with something like this, extending state surveillance, if you like, there would normally be far more parliamentary scrutiny. And there have now been reports that ministers are prepared to change tack and go for a version of the Apple and Google app if necessary. The Communities Secretary, Robert Jenrick, certainly left that possibility open this weekend.
We have an app that's being rolled out on the Isle of Wight,
but we
are also paying attention to what's happening elsewhere in the world. This is a pilot in the Isle of Wight. We're trying to get as many people to sign up to it as possible. We have around 50,000 people who've downloaded it.
I'm sorry, can I just ask specifically, are you looking at a second app or not?
We are learning lessons from the other apps that exist elsewhere in the world, and if we need to change our app, we will do. That's the point of piloting this before we take it national across the whole country. But I'd like
one of the reasons they wanted to go it alone was this point on self-diagnosis. Why do they think that's important?
Any app like this will lead to false positives and false negatives. There is no way of preventing them. And one of the big questions is how you manage that risk. Would you rather aggressively try and reduce the R0 by allowing things which might be false positives to go forward and making people self-isolate when they've been exposed to someone who maybe doesn't have coronavirus or when they may have not actually got close enough to catch it? Or do you go for false negatives and only make people self-isolate when they have cast iron definitely been exposed at the risk of missing people who, you know, were coughed on a bus they were only on for 3 minutes? It's a balancing act.
And is all of this what they're testing on the Isle of Wight right now?
I think what they're testing right now is, does the app work as we expect? Does it work through walls? Does it work in rain? Does it work in cars? Does it work on buses? Because until now, the actual dynamics of the app have only been tested in relatively controlled conditions on an RAF base. We don't really know how it works in normal people who keep their phones in handbags, who play Candy Crush, who listen to podcasts while they're walking, who go for runs. These are all the questions that we're going to be answering on the Isle of Wight.
Coming up, what happens if you need the app to get into a shop or into your office? If people do start to find that as we emerge from lockdown, the app really disrupts their life, isn't the risk just that they'll uninstall it or ignore the alerts? There's no legal requirement for us to download this app or listen to what it says.
Yeah. If you don't install this app, or if you install the app and get the notifications and decide to be risky anyway, then there's no legal right to stop you doing that. And, you know, in my opinion, nor should there be. This app relies on voluntary uptake.
And speaking of that, and speaking of India that we've already mentioned, there and in some other countries, there is talk of this being used in a more active way, like an immunity passport, an app that would be scanned as you get onto the tube or go into an office. Is there any chance that that could happen here?
Even if the government doesn't make the app mandatory to install, civil society could anyway. If Sainsbury's unilaterally says you have to have this app to come into our store, it's another one of these questions that the NHS really should be answering now. You know, will there be legislation to make it illegal to require this app to access certain services or to return to work?
Is that likely to happen? Are supermarkets likely to do that? Do we know whether workplaces are going to mandate this?
We don't. At one end of the spectrum, it's worth looking to China, where the traffic light system, a series of privately developed apps that give you red, green or yellow QR codes on your phone saying whether or not you're an infection risk, that has been largely built through private enterprise and voluntary cooperation. But it has resulted in a series of, effectively, biopassports. If you have the red QR code on your phone, a bunch of businesses and a bunch of individual Chinese states and regional authorities have voluntarily decided to lock you out of services until you become not a risk. The UK is not China, and I think it would be a bigger step to do that. I think employers are the thin end of the wedge there. If you are going to tell people to come back to the office, I can see why you might say, and please, please, please install the app because we want to know who you've infected in our large office. We don't want to have to shut down the entire office based on one positive test. And I can see how they could quite easily step from please, please, please install the app to install the app or don't come back.
Alex, what if everything went right? If 60% of the overall population, maybe 80% of people with smartphones downloaded it and everyone followed the instructions, there were no technical errors, would it get the country back on its feet?
It would allow the country to reopen without needing a second wave of lockdowns. It wouldn't get rid of coronavirus, but the country as a whole could run much closer to normality than if we tried to do this in a brute force, non-digital way.
Alex, if you just cast your mind back a year to May 2019, what would you have made of an app like this that needed to be downloaded by 60% of the population?
Back then, I'd have laughed at that sheer scale without the resources of a Facebook or a Google and with the fundamental, you know, uncoolness of a government app. I couldn't see how the government would ever be able to get that level of install.
What about now? Would you download it?
Now everything's changed. Yeah, I would absolutely download it. I am a privacy fundamentalist, self-described and described by others. I am the sort of person who turns off every piece of extra tracking that Google tries to do from me. And I would install this app because coronavirus is really awful. I want to get out of lockdown. And I think mass voluntary participation in this is going to be crucial to moving towards a more open society.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was our UK technology editor, Alex Hearn. Do go to theguardian.com to read his reporting on this. You can also have a look at the reporting from our investigations team led by Paul Lewis. And this week, extensive coverage of the government's first steps towards lifting the lockdown, including from our Westminster team and across the country. Do have a read. That's it for today. My thanks to Dr. Tom Moore and to Alex Hearn. This episode was produced by Chika Ayres. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.